afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Other Minds and Hands. This is session number 70 as we return today to The Lord of the Rings. So Maggie and I wanted to start. We've talked about this before. We've spent a while discussing our openings series where we've been looking. And to kind of back up from that a little bit, one of the things that I have been really interested to do as we've been doing these series, like the reason for doing them is to be doing some close comparison and contrast so that we can come to understand better the relationship between text and film. What is going on? What are the elements at work? What are the advantages and disadvantages? What are the toolkits that both, you know, text writers and film producers have at their disposal in order to tell stories? The better we can understand that, the better we're going to be able to understand and contextualize what's happening in any given adaptation.
I'm so glad you said it that way, because that's like whenever I try to sum up what we do on this show, I'm like, we try to give better tools for people's adaptation toolkits.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that's what it is, because what we're about to do is a pretty close comparison between text and film, and that you will find in any Google form, any form you search, you will find a comparison. Here's what it says in the text, here's what it says in the film, as if this one is right and this one is wrong.
Yes.
That's not what we're doing. What
yes.
we're doing is looking at the text and looking at the film and showing how they do what they do in a certain way.
Yeah.
So yeah, this looks like we're doing a complete compare and contrast, but it's going to be analysis, right?
Exactly. Because one of the things that I think is so important is to think, so the comparison that I'm making here in my little title that I put here, Translation and Interpretation, is a lot like translation. Like you can't, if you have something in one language and you're translating it into another language, you can do an excellent translation and it's not the same. It's not the same because the two languages are themselves different. And so what our goal was here, again, in doing this the kind of comparison that we've been doing in our opening series, what we've been trying to do is we've been focusing on particular scenes, on the opening sequences of the books and the films that we've been comparing. And yet we're still kind of doing a sort of a bigger picture thing, right? We're looking at, like, what is the frame? How are we being invited in these first moments, these first paragraphs, these first minutes of these productions? How are we being invited to look at things, right? What kind of relationship is being established with us? What kind of ideas are being established and how, right? So that was one way in which we were looking at these different different approaches, these different tools that the two different media have at their disposal and what they're doing and how that informs the interpretive adaptation choices that the adaptation is making. What we're doing now, this is the beginning of a new series, which is going to be trying to get at a similar kind of thing, but in a different way. And so what we're doing here is we're choosing scenes from a book and film that are really, really close together. Like, we're not looking...
The same book and film,
right? So a film adaptation of a book in which they're doing a very, very, very similar thing. So we're not looking at, like, you know, the adaptation choices that they, you know, like the kinds of choices that they make where they sort of deviate in significant ways. The point is, again, it as a storytelling medium, right? What are the ways when they're as close as like we can find them, basically? When we feel that they're sticking, you know, they're really trying to do. And in that way, if you see, Maggie, what I mean by the metaphor, that's what I mean, that it's like translation, right? Translating a thing from one language to another. So not
totally
where they deviate and why, though that's interesting, and we talk about that too in lots of other places, but where they're like, they seem to be really trying to do the same thing. And let's look carefully at how they do that thing and how that works. So, that's what we're going to be doing. And I will say as a side note that, so we're doing the Peter Jackson films and The Lord of the Rings. And I have to say, I found it really hard to find like the right scene to do this. For as much as lots and lots of people like to say, like, oh, the Peter Jackson films stay really close to the text, every single example that I came up with, I'm like, no, it's too different. No, it's too different.
Corey went through about 30 of these when we were talking after last week's show. And, you know, his knowledge of the text is obviously far superior to mine. So I kept coming up with some that I thought were pretty close. And he was like, yeah, no.
No, it's too different.
Yeah, no. but even the ones that were close, there were still, you know, probably 10 or so that you had in the running of like, let's, you know, think about these. So we've got a big cache of ones that we can play with.
Yeah.
But we're starting with a very well-known one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we are. So like, let me give like a quick example of what I mean. So one example that jumped to my mind right away is the fire writing on the ring is revealed for the first time. Frodo and Gandalf having the conversation in Bag End. But the problem was the context of that conversation is so different in the film with Gandalf like, you know, rushing back and throwing the envelope in the fire. I mean, I was like, no, it's too different. And again, not there's anything wrong with that, but it wouldn't accomplish what we wanted to do. Like, to look at them making very similar kinds of story choices and looking instead at the mechanism of how they do that. So the choice, the scene that we're looking at today is the Cracks of Doom. We're looking at the throwing of the ring into the fire. So, okay, let's begin with the text.
Let's start at the very ending.
Exactly. Yeah. Doom falls at the Cracks of Doom. So here we go. So we're going to be focusing there are two things we'll be discussing. Mostly we're going to focus on Frodo, Sam, and Gollum and how that story is handled. And then we're going to look at Sauron's reaction and what happens to Sauron to sort of a lesser extent, but I included the text for all that. Okay, all right. The light sprang up again, and there on the brink of the chasm, at the very crack of doom, stood Frodo, black against the glare, tense, erect, but still as if he had been turned to stone. "Master!" cried Sam. Then Frodo stirred and spoke with a clear voice, indeed with a voice clearer and more powerful than Sam had ever heard him use, and it rose above the throb and turmoil of Mount Doom, ringing in the roof and walls. "I have come," he said, "but I do not choose now to do what I came to do. I will not do this deed. The ring is mine." And suddenly, as he set it on his finger, he vanished from Sam's sight. Sam gasped, but he had no chance to cry out, for at that moment many things happened. Something struck Sam violently in the back. His legs were knocked from under him, and he was flung aside, striking his head against the stony floor as a dark shape sprang over him. He lay still, and for a moment all went black. All right, so this is where we begin with the text. Now, one of the interesting things, Maggie, I know that you're really interested in how the film kind of cuts from one place to another here. Tolkien does exactly the same thing, right? He sets us up for this by saying, where was it? At that moment, several things happen at once. Oh, I've totally, like, missed that. I've misplaced that piece of text. Hang on. Oh, yes. For at that moment, many things happened, right? And then we get Gollum tackles him. But then Tolkien cuts. And far away, as Frodo put on the ring and claimed it for his own, even in Samothnaur, the very heart of his realm, the power in Barad-dûr was shaken, and the tower trembled from its foundations to its proud and bitter crown. The Dark Lord was suddenly aware of him, and his eye, piercing all shadows, looked across the plain to the door that he had made, and the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash, and all the devices of his enemies were at last laid bare. Then his wrath blazed in consuming flame, but his fear rose like a vast black smoke to choke him, for he knew his deadly peril and the thread upon which his doom now hung. Then comes one of my very favorite sentences in the whole book. From all his policies and webs of fear and treachery, from all his stratagems and wars, his mind shook free, and throughout his realm a tremor ran. His slaves quailed, and his armies halted, and his captains, suddenly steerless, bereft of will, wavered and despaired, for they were forgotten. The whole mind and purpose of the power that wielded them was now bent with overwhelming force upon the mountain. At his summons, wheeling with a rending cry, in a last desperate race there flew, faster than the winds, the Nazgul, the Ringwraiths, and with a storm of wings they hurtled southwards to Mount Doom. All right. Pretty cool, right?
So this is good stuff. I could listen to this all day.
Yeah.
So you know.
Shall I keep reading the rest of the passage, or do we want to talk about some things and some of these things and come back to the rest?
I want to talk about everything, but I kind of feel like we should read all the text first to just give us this foundation, because we're probably going to bounce a little bit while talking.
Yeah, I agree. All right. So now Tolkien, having zoomed over to the Black Tower, now cuts back. Sam got up. He was dazed, and blood streaming from his head dripped in his eyes. He groped forward, and then he saw a strange and terrible thing. Gollum on the edge of the abyss was fighting like a mad thing with an unseen foe. To and fro he swayed, now so near the brink that almost he tumbled in, now dragging back, falling to the ground, rising and falling again, and all the while he hissed but spoke no words. The fires below awoke in anger, the red light blazed, and all the cavern was filled with a great glare and heat. Suddenly Sam saw Gollum's long hands draw upwards to his mouth. His white fangs gleamed and then snapped as they bit. Frodo gave a cry, and there he was, fallen upon his knees at the chasm's edge. But Gollum, dancing like a mad thing, held aloft the ring, a finger still thrust within its circle. It shone now as if verily it was wrought of living fire. "Precious! Precious! Precious!" Gollum cried. "My precious! Oh, my precious!" And with that, even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, he stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek he fell. Out of the depths came his last wail, "Precious!" And he was gone. There was a roar and a great confusion of noise. Fires leaped up and licked the roof. The throbbing grew to a great tumult and the mountain shook. Sam ran to Frodo and picked him up and carried him out to the door. And there upon the dark threshold of the Samothnaur, high above the plains of Mordor, such wonder and terror came on him that he stood still, forgetting all else, and gazed as one turned to stone. A brief vision he had of swirling cloud, and in the midst of it, towers and battlements tall as hills, founded upon a mighty mountain throne above immeasurable pits, great courts and dungeons, eyeless prisons sheer as cliffs, and gaping gates of steel and adamant, and then all passed. Towers fell and mountains slid, walls crumbled and melted, crashing down. Vast spires of smoke and spouting steams went billowing up, up, until they toppled like an overwhelming wave, and its wild crest curled and came foaming down upon the land. And then at last, over the miles between them, came a rumble, rising to a deafening crash and roar. The earth shook, the plain heaved and cracked, and Orodruin reeled. Fire belched from its riven summit. The skies burst into thunder, seared with lightning. Down like lashing whips fell a torrent of black rain. And into the heart of the storm, with a cry that pierced all other sounds, tearing the clouds asunder, the Nazgul came, shooting like flaming bolts. As caught in the fiery ruin of hill and sky, they crackled, withered, and went out. All right, there we go. That is our passage.
Andy Serkis has nothing on you.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You can only imagine your kids growing up with you reading this to them.
Yeah.
Great.
Namus Arcanum, I agree. It is really interesting that we don't directly see the destruction of Barad-dûr, but get a vision that Sam has of it. Yes. I agree. It is very interesting. It's not even clear necessarily, I think, like what perspective we're seeing that. It's a brief vision, right?
And even if it's real, I mean, the word vision also implies that it could be a figment, right? So
right.
There's that kind of, did he see it or was it just fleeting?
Is it how much is he seeing? How much is his imagination? Is there perhaps some kind of... That there could be some kind of actual sort of link or connection, either of vision or of thought, between the Samothnaur and the Barad-dûr, is very possible, right? So, I mean, is it even possible that as Sauron's, you know, attention is focused right there on that doorway in which Sam is standing right at the moment, that he's somehow, you know, like connected to the mind of Sauron himself as things collapse. And so what we're actually seeing is even possibly from Sauron's point of view almost, you know, rather than Sam's. It's very unclear. And that kind of distancing of things, right, is a little bit kind of disorienting, kind of takes us out of this sort of immediate, and this happened next, and then this happened,
right,
and then this happened.
It's not a factual report anymore.
Yes.
But I think that really works in terms of text at the moment, because it's chaos, right? I mean, it's supposed to imply confusion. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm not thinking film at all, just thinking text of, like, if you take a step back and read that, all of a sudden we're not getting a factual play-by-play.
Yes.
We're getting, oh, good lordy, everything went crazy. And you start to feel that, even if it's just like a subcurrent as a reader, you're unsettled a little bit.
Yep.
Excellent tool of a writer to make
yeah.
the reader feel unsettled.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's glance back here to the beginning, and obviously I could spend a lot of time talking about this long passage, but just a few big picture stuff, a few big picture things, which I think are really relevant. Like, certainly, if I'm planning an adaptation of this, these are some of the main things that I'm thinking about, right, that I'm kind of drawing from the text here. One, I called the first slide The Choices of Frodo and Gollum, because both of those two things happen right there, and I think it's important that we don't overlook that. Tolkien has gone to great lengths to set that up, right? Frodo makes his choice. He claims the ring for himself. This is new and different from this. He's not just like, actually, I want to carry on being the ring bearer. He is not the ring bearer anymore. He is now the master. He is now, very briefly, the Lord of the Ring, right? Remember, Gandalf yells at Pippin, says, three cheers for cousin Frodo, Lord of the Ring, in Rivendell in the book. And Gandalf is like, Pippin, shut up, right? He doesn't say that, you know, he says, hush, right? But anyway, like, it's clearly what he's thinking. And anyway, Gandalf is like, don't say that. What are you, an idiot? Because that means something, right? Like, and it means, like, kind of the opposite of what Frodo is supposed to be doing and thinking. So anyway, but here Frodo is, briefly, the Lord of the Ring, right? He has claimed it. That's his choice. But Gollum makes a choice at the same time, and he comes and attacks Frodo. And this has been set up on a couple of occasions, that if Gollum ever attempted to take the ring from Frodo ever again, that he would be that Frodo would put on the ring, and he would command Gollum to cast himself off a cliff, that he would be cast into the fire himself. Like, we have been told that that's what's going to happen. Gollum is here making the choice to abandon any prudence.
Preservation.
Yeah, he brings his destruction, the destruction which Frodo has twice foretold, upon himself, exactly as Frodo has foretold it by doing this. But this moment when he leaps forward is a huge decision moment for Gollum.
It also helps show that draw, right? That he can't say no to the ring, so he would rather knowingly walk into his death and choose this
mm-hmm.
than
yes.
try to fight the power of the ring.
Absolutely. Yes. And I would emphasize, when I say this is the decision point, Tolkien says, and I agree with him, I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's a moment, one of those moments when Tolkien is doing interpretation of his text, like he quotes what the text says and then says what he thinks the text suggests. Tolkien is great about this. He never just, like, plays the author card, right, and is like,
yeah,
this is what it means because I say this is what it means. Instead, he does a reading like anybody else does a reading. And therefore, one could disagree with him if you have a different reading, theoretically, right? But he's a really good reader, too. And I agree with him when he says that he felt that Gollum's point of no return choice was at the stairs of Cir Ithungol when he does not relent and does go through with leading Frodo and Sam into, and that really from there, it was kind of over, like his path was set and there wasn't really any turning back from Gollum at that point. I agree with that. I'm not trying to, like, disagree with that, but this is that final that final moment. Because even right before this, Frodo has just said again to Gollum, like, presented him with a choice, right? And now Gollum is making his choice. Okay, so that's, so, like, the choices and what these choices mean is one thing that I would be thinking about when I'm thinking about how do I represent this on screen. When it comes to Sauron, the emphasis, the division in Sauron that Tolkien emphasizes seems to me really sort of the central thing, right? His wrath and his fear. His sudden comprehension of what his enemies were. He now sees through everything, right? Oh my gosh, they have just been suckering me into attacking them, into, you know, like the whole, this whole, he knows why they're attacking the Black Gate. He knows that they have duped him and led him to believe that the ring was at the Black Gate, that one of the, either Gandalf or Aragorn, and probably Aragorn, has claimed the ring and is coming for him in order to throw him down. And that really all of this, like, that the whole plan of, you know, Gandalf and company all along was to sneak in and destroy the ring. So he now figures this out. And the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash, and all the devices of his enemies were at last laid bare. Again, that wrath and fear, this sense of the helplessness of Sauron in this moment is remarkable. And it's one of the things that sets, that makes this scene, I think, so powerful, because through the whole book, you know, that is to say through the whole Lord of the Rings, you know, this question has been like, how can we remember Frodo in the parlor of Bag End in chapter 2 talking to Gandalf, right, when Gandalf is first like laying the series of bad news upon him about what his ring is and what's going on, you know, Frodo is just like completely gobsmacked by the disproportion of the whole thing. How can I oppose the enemy? You know, and like, what can I do? What? Even when Gandalf starts talking about how Sauron might seek revenge, and Frodo's like, revenge for what? Like, right. Who am I? Like, why should the Dark Lord care about me? You know, anyway, so it's that sense of disproportion, right?
Yeah.
And yet when it comes to it, and this sense gets repeated all the way through, like, it's hopeless to do this. There's the, you know, Denethor's sense of despair, which is perfectly rational despair in, you know, based on everything that Denethor knows. And yet when it comes to it, Sauron the great enemy, it's not about fighting Sauron the great enemy at all, right? Sauron the great enemy is utterly helpless to prevent this, and like the only hope of Sauron is the, like, with the failure of Frodo, like, that it's not, the Nazgûl aren't going to get there in time, right? Like, it's you know, they're the fastest who can get there. Sauron can't get there. They can get there, you know, on their giant vultures or whatever, but they can't. Tolkien always called them vultures, by the way. But anyhow, So, it's that second paragraph. What I love, I said that first sentence is one of my favorite sentences in The Lord of the Rings. I love the balance of that sentence and the balance of that whole paragraph. From all his policies and webs of fear and treachery, from all his stratagems and wars, his mind shook free. That is all of the power, all the horribly intimidating things that he's, all these manifestations of his will and his power that make him this undefeatable force. He shoves them all aside, right? And all of... Go ahead.
That just made me think of just the use of those words. I mean, he's choosing really strong, structured words that are difficult to fight with. Policies, stratagems,
Yes.
realms. These are very organized, methodical
Yes.
things.
Yes. Even the idea of webs, right? Like you could, like the intricacy of the network of everything that he has set up. Yes, it's like someone who has built up this incredibly enormous and intricate thing, and this is the picture of him just shoving it all off the table onto the
Exactly,
floor.
like a super organized dude is saying,
Yes.
that's not going to help me now. A type A person destroying their spreadsheets, right? Like,
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. No, that's exactly it. And his slaves quail and his armies halt and his captains waver because for they were forgotten, right? The
yes.
whole mind and purpose of the power that wielded them was now bent with overwhelming force upon the mountain, and it doesn't say this, and it could do nothing, right? It is completely helpless. And so even the picture that we get of the slaves and the captains and the armies wavering and despairing, suddenly steerless, right? That's Sauron himself is in that position, right? His force is overwhelming, but there is nothing he can do. So yes, so trying to capture Sauron's situation here, right? Sauron's circumstance, that's a really fascinating challenge. Now we get the fight, right? Sam, of course, is our like spectator and point of view character for the whole scene, right? He doesn't actually do anything other than get knocked over and watch the
In the
things
text.
happen. Yeah, in the text, exactly. That's Sam's position. We see the fight between Gollum and invisible Frodo. And then we see the biting off of the finger. Someone was asking before, why isn't Frodo's finger still invisible? That's actually an excellent moment to sort of illustrate how the power of the ring works, right? It's not, the ring isn't like some kind of invisibility potion or paint or something like that, right? That work kind of automatically on anything. Like as if you put the ring on a hat rack, the hat rack becomes invisible or something like that, right? It's not. Why is Frodo's visible? Because it's not part of Frodo anymore. It was never making Frodo's finger invisible. It wasn't ever interested in Frodo's, but it was interested in Frodo, right? The putting of the ring on the finger is merely the like outward sign of the claiming of the ring for himself and of the you know himself being impacted by the power of the ring, sort of, I'll use this word very cautiously, but sort of transformed by the power of the ring, somewhere else, some into something else. That's why you can't see him, right? And yeah, now his finger is just a, it's just a piece of meat with the ring on it, right? And so it's not affected by the ring in any way. Frodo is fallen upon his knees at the chasm's edge, and we don't see Frodo do anything else again after this. This is a really cool point, and I this is a marvelous question, Brave Brown Bear's question on Twitch, because Brave Brown Bear is very appropriately drawing attention to like how Tolkien as writer is using the tools that he has, right? And the question is, why does Tolkien say that Sam saw this and that rather than just describe this and that, right? What's the point? Marvelous question. It's about where we are placed in
Perspective.
the imaginative frame. Yes. We what that the difference is, if he just describes this and that, he is inviting us to imagine this as if we were seeing it, right? By saying Sam saw this and that, he's inviting us to see he's not only inviting us to see Sam as part of the picture, right? But he's inviting us to recognize that we're seeing these things from Sam's point of view. There are some shifts in point of view. Look at this one. There's like one really kind of subtle thing, right? In the first passage, the light sprang up again, and there on the brink of the chasm, at the very crack of doom, stood Frodo. That's how Sam would think of it, right? They've been talking about the cracks of doom. He is first described as like what it looked. There's a chasm there, and is at the brink of the chasm, at the very crack of doom. Like he realizes, like, this is the crack of, we've been talking about the cracks of doom for you know, like a year, right? Well, months anyway. And this is it, the very crack of doom, right? But watch what happens when the perspective shifts to Sauron's perspective. And far away, as Frodo put on the ring and claimed it for his own, even in Samoth-Naur, the very heart of his realm. Sam doesn't think of it as Samoth-Naur, the heart of the realm of Sauron, but Sauron does, right? Sauron knows its name, and he knows the importance. This is not to Sauron the very crack of doom, and it is certainly not some chasm with fire at the bottom, right? When we shift to Sauron's perspective, now all of a sudden, this is even in Samoth-Naur, the very heart of his realm, right? Because he thinks about this very differently. So we do... We can see evidence like this of how even the description of things is being colored by the point of view of the person whom he is describing as seeing those things. And he's made those one of the effects of those choices, the effect of the Sam choice here, is that he puts us alongside Sam. It is Sam's experience of this scene that he's inviting us to share. We don't know what this scene was like for Frodo. We're not invited to share Frodo's experience here, or Gollum's experience. We're invited to share Sam's and a little bit of Sauron's, right? Those are the two things we're invited to share. And that's what... Now, keep in mind, Aslan's Compass, I'm not here talking about the question, which is a different and very interesting question, about who wrote these passages of narrative down in the Red Book later on. Right. I'm talking about whose perspective we're seeing, what we're given here in the text. So the question of the composition of the text, even the fictional composition of the text, is a separate question and not what I'm talking about here.
And we've often talked about through line when we talk about adaptation and who's mm-hmm. the through line of the story. So we can certainly go into that when we do more of the film analysis side of stuff. But I think this is a good example of through line in a text, too, because it's giving us a perspective of Sam and we're seeing everything from Sam's point of view. There's two really powerful things with that, I think. Like, seeing Sauron's perspective is so contrasting that you see it is night and day. They are polar opposites of how one would view the world, Sauron and Sam, like purity and not. And then mm-hmm. also having that connection with Frodo, seeing through Sam's eyes the destruction of his master, yes. best friend, whatever relationship you define that as, that is such a powerful conduit to see the betrayal and the power of the ring. So using Sam for that perspective is an excellent tool to show that strength in those relationships.
Yes.
Without having to be like, and his best friend was corrupted. It's like, no, we're going to take you through this from my eyeballs.
Yes.
And you're going to feel it the same way I do.
Absolutely. It's something, in exploring the Lord of the Rings, this is something that I've been noticing a lot as we've been going through the text, that one of the things that makes Tolkien's sort of descriptions and descriptions of actions so powerful is that he almost never just like he doesn't ever tell us how to feel. He describes how the point of view characters are yeah. feeling, right, and invites us to imagine ourselves into their positions, right? But
it's such a powerful like empath yeah. thing mm-hmm. to be able to bring somebody on an emotional journey is huge. And if you do want to look at the film, I think you could see there's a lot of arguments of how Sam is the through line of this. And, you know, even production wise, like he was the one that was pushed, Sean Astin, to get Best Supporting Actor awards. And there were campaigns for him to get the Academy Award and adverts put out and things like that. Like, they're really pushing for him to be the one that drove the story forward in a number of scenes. And I feel like this is a really clear moment where we see that. So I don't know if you want to talk about film analysis here, but this passage, that statement just really makes sense
Yeah,
of
no,
how strong
agreed.
that is for Sam.
Agreed. Yeah, no, that's I think that it's one of the thing. I mean, it's I think it's good to talk about that, 'cause a lot of the specific things about the film version of this are going to be a little bit more like detail focused, but that as a kind of a big picture thing, I agree that we do see them. The point of view thing isn't exactly, I don't think point of view works exactly the same in film as it does in books like this, right? Or do you think that it does? So I.
I don't, I mean, it depends how that moment is being told. I know what you're saying, 'cause like point of view is a little narrower with the text because we're getting a pretty tunnel vision of what's going on.
Yes.
There's a certain amount of establishment shot with
Right.
knowing where we are, but most of our work in a text is pretty narrow.
Yeah.
But a film, my God, there's so many perspectives that it's really hard to talk point of view because you have the point of view of the camera,
Yes.
right? Like, what's the shot? Right now, the shot of me is a medium close up. So, like, you're seeing mostly me and a little bit of background. You can probably infer where I am. The
Right.
lighting is bad. The sound is echoey. Like, there's so many things that kind of set the tone
Right.
of my shot. Take
Right.
it into a film production, and you've got like an establishing shot that's going to show you we're at the crack of Mount Doom, but we're not entirely sure who's there yet because they're teeny tiny. But then you get a crane shot coming in and zooming in on a smoke soot covered face that is pained, and we see who we are, but we see that they've been through trials. And then the music swells, and then the tears start, and then you look at the costumes, which are ripped. Like, there's so many ways. Yeah, I
Yeah.
digress, but you guys get it. Like, there's so many ways for us to see what is being told in that moment. So that's part of what we're going to do here is take a look at some of the stuff and go through that. But exactly, I think it's tough to just say the point of view in the film. Which point of view are you looking at? Like,
Yeah.
camera angle?
Right. Well,
Music?
exactly. And point of view is something like when people talk about film and TV, they'll say things like, this person is the point of view character of this scene or even of this, you know, episode or film, right? But it seems to me that what that means in a film context is that that person is kind of the through line, as you said. Like, that's going to be their, that person is going to be the one that we sort of primarily are visually connecting with. But we're not actually getting their point of view. Sometimes a film may play on, like, if a particular character doesn't notice something, and so they don't show it to us either. And later on, we see the same scene from a different perspective and see something that the other we didn't see the other time, and that the other character didn't notice, or something like that. But by and large, again, I was just pointing to one example of how I believe the actual description of what we're being told about here is being colored by Sam's point of view, right? As and by Sauron's point of view. Honestly, even the you talked about like being type A, which is very Sauron. Even the like architectonic structure of those sentences is very Sauron, right? And we see that kind of sentence many times in these in this bit as we're looking, you know, several times. Anyway, point is, in a film, yes, we might focus on a particular character most often. Yes, that character's experiences might be the dominant thread of the narrative that we're being asked to follow, and yet much more rarely is our own perception of like what we're seeing colored by the like bias and perspective. You know what I mean? Like, again, that can be played with, but I do think that the point of view character means something different in that way in film.
And I think Phil pointed out well in the chat here too, like, sometimes you get first person point of view in a video game, almost never in a film,
Yes.
often in a book. So that's a really interesting example of like user ability, right? Like, if
Yep.
I'm in a text and I'm doing first person, that's helpful. Sometimes it can take me into the scene, it can give me some emotion, it can set the scene of where I am because my focus is more narrow. I can focus on this character In a game, you are the player. You are the one running through this. You're supposed to not see everything. So when something jumps out, it's a thing you
Right.
react
If the
to.
camera's not pointed in the right direction, the thing will jump on you from
Comes up
behind.
behind. Right. So then that's what I was going to say. So like the t when you see first person in a film, it's used as its own device
Yes.
to minimize what information you're allowed to intake. Like it's used as a filter. Like it's very rare that you get a film in first person. I can't even think of one. Like Being John Malkovich is the only one I can really think of at the moment where you literally go inside John Malkovich's head and become John Malkovich. And it's so limiting
Do you
because you
remember
only get these.
do you remember the Kenneth Branagh Emma Thompson film Dead Again?
No,
With
but that.
was it Derek Jacobi was in that too.
Oh.
Anyway, that film has a moment where like the because it's like a past life thing, so they're having like dreams of like a past life experience and stuff, and there are moments when it actually shifts to first person camera angle. Like first person camera angle such that like you go by a mirror and see who it is that's seeing and they don't even know, right? Like that kind of thing. But that the point is when the camera shifts to an actual first person perspective, it's like for a narrow time and for a very peculiar reason, and it feels like it's a huge deal when it happens.
It is, and it's either that's like a reveal, right? So it's putting you in first person to give you a
Yes.
really like unique moment of information. But usually it's the opposite, where it's a filter to remove information, like a horror film. So that
Yes.
you the genre you most often see first person point of view is horror, running through
Yes.
the house with an axe murderer chasing you, and a handy cam, being your
Right.
eyeballs and keeping you all discombobulated
Right.
because you're not supposed to get all the information.
Yep.
So yeah, it's just a tougher one to use in film because it has its own device that is limiting rather than enlightening. You
Yes.
need these other things to kind of paint the big picture, and there's other ways to get emotion. Whereas in a text, it's often a really good tool to get closer to emotion by using first person.
Yes. Yeah, it is as you say, the limitation, I mean, there are limitations implicit in like describing the scene from Sam's within the context of Sam's understanding, right? Like for instance, he doesn't realize this is the Samoth now or the heart of Sauron's realm. Like he doesn't understand the significance of this place. That this
And
is,
he
yeah, where they are is the center of Sauron's power. Like and there's a moment there is the one moment when Sam does come to get a glimpse of this. He pulls out the vial of Galadriel and it doesn't do anything. Because there in the heart of Sauron's
part of
realm, all other power is suppressed and nothing else has the power to do anything. But anyway, the point is like there are limitations, but I agree. It's not as it's a much subtler, gentler and less intrusive kind of limitation of our perception and understanding than a film camera angle, a point of view perception, first person perception is. Yeah. Anyway, so, but hey, Brave Brown, great question. This is exactly the kind of thing that, again, that we want to be drawing attention to. In looking at the text here, what we're doing is not just essentially saying, isn't this passage awesome and isn't Tolkien cool? The question, I mean, those things are obviously true, but the question is, what is Tolkien doing and how is he accomplishing it, right? What techniques can we see the writer doing when he is writing here, so that we can be sort of comparing some of those things. Anyway, so that's why the Sam question was such a great question. By the way, actually, on the third slide here is another great illustration of the limitations of point of view. The fires below awoke in anger. The second paragraph there begins, right? Why are the fires awaking in anger? I think I know. Maybe because the whole mind and purpose of the power that wielded them was now bent with overwhelming force upon the mountain. Maybe that's why the fires at the heart of his realm are responding in anger. Right? But Sam doesn't know that, right? Sam is just
Right.
looking and he sees Frodo claim the ring and Gollum and invisible Frodo are fighting, right? And then the fires leap up and it it's the fires awoke in anger, as if they're responding to what is happening up there. That's the context in which Sam is seeing it, right? Yeah.
But also just through a simple interpretation, that's just adding to the pace, you know? So,
yes.
And one thing we didn't mention before was pace of,
yes.
of this intercut between the battle that's going on outside of Mount Doom and inside of Mount Doom between the two parties. All of this is being cut together to build tension. So
yes.
the fact that we're able to bounce back and forth between these two camps and purely build tension is one device. But while doing that, Tolkien is playing on power, emotion, laws of physics and earth, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
all these things are coming into play. So seeing that kind of power through Sam's eyes, when we know the truth of what that is so much more powerful when that flame comes up, because we know the actual repercussions of that. Whereas Sam might a little bit, but he's probably just more focused on, oh God, this is dangerous.
Yes.
That we get that feeling from him, but we have the depth of understanding of what that actually represents.
Yeah.
Harder to do on film. So very cool that they were able to lay that foundation in text.
Yeah, it is. Just a couple more things that we do want to move on to analysis of the film as well. But this seems important in the context of what we're going to see in the film. Notice what Tolkien does not show us visually here. And with that, even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, he, Gollum, stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek, fell. Out of the depths came his last wail, precious, and he was gone. We do not see Gollum hit the lava. We do not see the ring destroyed. All we see, from Sam's point of view, is Gollum fall over backwards. We only know for sure that he fell in because of the wail that we hear coming up, right? The last word of Gollum, precious. And he was gone. Notice, he was gone. It's not even it was gone. Sam's not thinking about the ring here, right? Sam's thinking about Frodo and thinking about Gollum and Gollum qua threat to Frodo primarily, right?
Right.
But it is remarkable that we don't, for all the significance of the destruction of the ring, we don't see it. And
yeah.
that is something I think, again, that's a huge medium issue, right? And it is wholly unsurprising that the film is going to make a very different choice when it comes to the destruction of the ring, right?
And both can be incredibly effective.
Yeah.
You know, not seeing it in the text has its own impact.
Yes.
But again, we're not talking one is right, one is wrong. You know,
yeah.
this is different. It's purely, wow, both are very impactful, and here's some different ways that they're doing that.
And again, I would go back to the translation thing. Just as certain words and turns of phrase will be powerful and effective in one language, but if you translate it literally, if you try to translate that literally into the other language, you'll end up sounding dumb, right? That happens all the time, right? Try it out with Google Translate and you'll see examples. You can make examples easily enough, right? And that's, it's exactly why, just as in a good translation, you don't want, you don't, if you're trying to capture what the original text was doing, you don't want to just do a literal word-for-word translation at all points. You want to try to capture what they were doing, and I think that's exactly what we see in the film there. The last thing that I will emphasize is that brief vision that Sam had, and we talked about some of the kind of perspective ambiguity of that. The way that this is, like, what is being conveyed in the description of the destruction, right? We have a brief vision. First, it's the vision of strength, and not only of strength, but of the particular kind of strength that it is. towers and battlements tall as hills, founded upon a mighty mountain throne above immeasurable pits, great courts and dungeons, eyeless prisons sheer as cliffs, and gaping gates of steel and adamant. And then all passed. Towers fell and mountains slid, walls crumbled and melted, crashing down. We get this...
I love this bit.
Cataclysmic destruction, which sounds like the end of the world, you know? Towers fell and mountains slid. You know, like mountains being cast into the sea. Like that's what we're the kind of thing that we're seeing here, right? Vast spires of smoke and spouting steams went billowing up until they toppled like an overwhelming wave, and its wild crest curled and came foaming down upon the land. Curled and came foaming. That doesn't normally happen with smoke. You notice that? Like that, so it comes up and then crests like a wave and boom, crashes down upon the land. The smoke does. Again, that's not normal, right? How that works. Toppled like an overwhelming wave. File this under, we have absolutely no time to talk about this, but just like footnote, see Numenor. End footnote. Okay. And or like, you know, hashtag Numenor parallels is kind of what we're, in large part, what we're seeing there. And I love how this moment of naturalism, right? We see all these things, and then at last, over the miles between, there came a rumble that is pointing out the gap in time between seeing the thing collapse in the distance, and then after, over the miles, then you hear the rumble rising to a deafening crash and roar, that the seeing and the hearing of the collapse of Barad-dûr strikes Sam as two different sort of wholly independent phenomena and those two different things. And by the way, that's a thing we very rarely see on film, right? Film is almost always, like, almost always brings us immediately into things, right? The, like, that whole experience of seeing something happen in the distance, so far away that the sound gets to you several seconds later, right? Is not often a kind of experience that film tries to capture. Instead, it'll zoom us up, right, so that we see the thing happening immediately. But of course, like, we've all experienced that kind of thing, to see something happen and then you hear the sound a little bit later.
And I'm just thinking of examples, and the only ones I can come up with are bombs being dropped and waves crashing. So, like, a tsunami, you see it coming, it hits. The, you know, bombs being dropped in films, mm-hmm. you see the mushroom cloud and then feel the wave and the crash and the wind and things.
That's true. We do sometimes get that kind of effect with nuclear blasts in films. Yeah, that's true.
That's probably the closest thing you can compare it to. So it is still ultimate, incredibly powerful destruction from very far away, mm-hmm. and you're witnessing, and then, you know, that's hitting you.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You're right. I hadn't thought of that parallel, but that's true. Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about the film. So you gave us a couple
Wait, I wanted you to read script. That. Two more sentences is one of my favorite lines.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, yeah? With the description of the Nazgul?
Fire belched from its riven summit.
Yes, fire belched from its riven summit. The skies burst into thunder, seared with lightning. Down like lashing whips fell a torrent of black rain, and into the heart of the storm. Notice all of these things. Like, down like lashing whips, especially. Think of all the references to the slaves of Mordor that have been done, right? And so it's like is this, like, the spirit of Sauron released into the clouds, still attempting to, like, regain control? Or is this, like, the whips coming down upon Sauron himself? Like, you know, the world, like, nature, like, turning back on Sauron. And we get this brief image of, like, what, he did to others happening to him. I'm not sure which way it's supposed to work there, but and then
but
the
you
Nazgul.
Can read lots of those.
Yeah. And then the Nazgul, and into the heart of the storm with a cry that pierced all other sounds, tearing the clouds asunder, the Nazgul came. Note how we have it's. We've already seen several times now the eagles come in and rescue things, and the Nazgul almost sound like that. Like, notice how the Nazgul are described as if they're stronger and more powerful than the storm, right? Their cry pierces all other sounds. It's tearing the clouds themselves asunder, like they're going to come in and rescue Sauron or something. The Nazgul came, shooting like flaming bolts, just like the thunder seared with lightning and the torrent of black rain, right? As caught in the fiery ruin of Hillen's sky, they crackled, withered, and went out. And so actually, instead of being like eagles, they end up being like, you know, mosquitoes in the bug zapper instead. And they just fizzle out like sparks in a campfire, right?
And I also like that bit because of what we were talking about, that the threat seems so far away and the destruction is so far away, and then you are so immediately in it, you know, fire raining and things attacking and swooping and falling and lashing and just these very active, threatening, close things. It's a nice contrast.
Yeah. Quick response to Brave Brown Bear there. Yes, the text does say that this is a vision. As far as the distance mattering and stuff, one of the effects of the reference to the gap between the vision and the sound coming is actually to kind of return us to Sam's point of view standing there, right? I do think that he has a vision. I don't think he's pretty far from Barad-dûr. There's no way he could see this much detail from where he is. I think there is a vision. This is not just what he can see. What he can see with his physical eyes is doubtless like a cloud on the horizon, right? I mean, he's pretty far away. But nevertheless, that element, right? That element of like seeing the vision and then hearing the sound afterwards does convey the idea of distance, right? And it does convey that, and again, it kind of brings us back in some ways to Sam's perspective. No, they're not in a tunnel. He's at the door, right? Sam picked him up and carried him out to the door and there upon the dark threshold. So he's not down the tunnel. He's up at the top end of the tunnel looking out. Is where. So it's like that he has a line of sight on Barad-dûr is clear. We know there is a direct line of sight between the two. They're aligned that way. But it's pretty far away. It's pretty far away. Okay. Yeah, Nemus Arcanum, Barad-dûr is wreathed in shadow of some kind. Yeah, it was before when they saw it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's look at the text. Or not the text. Let's look at the film. Right. Let's look at some of the decisions that they make there. So Maggie, you wanted to look at the script. We have the script. The script is fun to see. One of the things that I notice about the script is all the exclamation points. There's so many exclamation points in this scene in the script, right? Even the stage directions have exclamations point.
Vanishes.
Right?
Yeah.
Frodo puts on the ring. He vanishes. Right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's in all caps. Must have enthusiasm. Yeah.
Yes.
Pretty limited ways to get, you know, intention across in a short script. So you got to use the tools that you have.
Yes. Yeah.
But I did think this was interesting, though, to just pull up, like, purely just as an exercise. If you've never read a film script, I highly recommend it, especially of a film that you love. Mm-hmm. Go read the script, because I feel like it's such an eye-opening exercise of how limited the text can often be to what you see on the screen. Mm-hmm. So it's also a really good way to just look at something and see how many different interpretations could come from this. Like, this doesn't actually give you a lot to work with.
Yes.
You really have to rely on the understanding of the director and the depth passion of the actor and the costumer putting in the detail. Like, I know I keep saying it, but it is all these things coming together
Yes.
to make sure that a real story is told. So just comparing script to text is not what you should do. But
Yes.
it's a really good exercise of how to look at how something could be portrayed. And I thought this one was just quite interesting because we were talking about the different bits from the text. And yes, there's differences here. Sam has a lot more lines. They make the perspective of Sam verbal as opposed to the perspective textually that we get in the book. So giving him a few more lines and giving him that time to say a few things gives us that same kind of idea of betrayal and shock, and this is somebody I know. It allows us to go on that path.
Yeah.
But you also see, sorry, go ahead.
No. Finish.
Oh, but you also see some great descriptions here that you'll recognize from the text,
Yes.
that are full-on lines and phrases pulled from the text. Which I think is just showing their familiarity with it. They didn't advertise, how close the script was to the text in these places, but it does show a certain understanding of the respect for Tolkien's words and how beautifully that paints a picture. But also, these are really visual words. So if I am an actor that's not familiar with Lord of the Rings and I am reading this, I'm going to see how intense this destruction is because Tolkien was so good at it. And it gives us the right tone and it gives us the right,
Yeah.
visuals.
One of the things that really jumps out to me in this page of script is a deep lava-filled chasm in the very heart of ancient Sauron's forges, the greatest in Middle-earth. And thing is, I don't see that in the film. Like that, I don't see any evidence of how that idea, which is stated right there in the script, is actually being visually manifested in the scene in front of
Yeah,
me.
it's certainly the most powerful lava-filled chasm I've ever seen, but I would not
Yes.
show any evidence of a forge.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. If I hadn't been told and I knew nothing else, I wouldn't know that this was a forge, right? So yeah, it is interesting to kind of one of the things that it really emphasizes to me is you can see in part they're really pointing to, because, well, I think about it this way. Who's the target audience of the stage directions? The target audience of the stage directions are mostly the director and the actors, right?
Simply, yeah. Probably a bit broader than that, but I would say
Yeah.
that's the most direct.
Yeah,
I mean, it
exactly.
also goes to the studio who decides if it's going to get funded. It also goes to the set
Yes.
designer who
Okay,
decides the
they're the
thing.
primary. The studio who decides if it gets funded are probably the primary audience, literally speaking. But as far as like it's what it's meant to do, right? You know,
What it's meant to convey.
the work that that it's doing, right? Anyway, so like it's they felt it important to convey, you know, to like, you know, director. Now, of course, in this case, actor or writer and director are the same, you know, so that there's not a gap, but that's not always the case, right? But in any case, this idea of the very heart of ancient Sauron's forges, greatest in Middle-earth, they felt that important to convey, even though in the end, when trying to translate this concept into film, they didn't end up making very clear choices to try to communicate that.
No, and even the chat here in Twitch is asking about the forging in the prologue of the first film. Yes, this might be supposed to reminding us of that prologue, but we don't actually see a physical forging
No.
in the prologue. We just see the rings being handed out, and we see Sauron holding the
Holding
one
up
ring
the one, yeah.
above the fires of Mount Doom with this beautiful upshot to make him super powerful and foreboding, but we never actually see the forging.
Yeah.
So
We don't
a
see anybody
reference.
wielding a hammer. You know, or like, I mean, to have a forge, you need a hammer, you need an anvil, right? You need to, yeah.
Isn't he actually wielding a knife in that scene? He's in the film, he's not holding anything that would make one think that he was the actual creator of that ring.
No, not really. Not really. But again, it's, in any case, we still don't get anything. There is no, the point is there's no evidence in this scene of anything that prompts us at this moment to remember that it's a forge, right?
Right.
I mean, like, there could have been, they could have done it. They could have put, like, off to the side in, like, where they're fighting and stuff, like a big anvil sitting there, right?
Yeah.
Like, you could have had that as part of the set, right? Just be like, FYI, forge, you know? Like,
you could have, but also that's not where, we don't need to know, right?
Yeah, like, no, I agree.
Just thinking about in terms of information that we have, in the fires of Mordor, was it made? And in the fires of Mount Doom, can it only be unmade? That's all we need to know. And here we are in the fires.
And there's the fires, so right there. Yep.
We assume it can be unmade. We don't need to see the forge.
Exactly.
But the forge is in the script.
But the forge is in the script. That's my point. The forge is in the script.
Yeah.
And yet they do the opposite of going out of their way to make to remind us visually that it's a forge, right?
And you imagine there would have been a conversation between Peter Jackson and the set designer being like, so do you want some forge?
How forgy do you want it? You know, on a scale of 1 to 10. Yes.
Yeah, like, do you want an apron on a hook? Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that clearly made the script, but was not necessary in the film. And you see that a lot, too. And a working script is not always the same as a shooting script, either. So... Mm-hmm. You know, this is one I found online, and Brave Brown Bear did ask earlier, are movie scripts generally available? Yes. If you just Google your favorite film, and I recommend putting PDF at the end of it, you'll usually find it. You have to be careful that it's not a fake or something, but generally you'll find it. And they want them to be publicly available. So you can usually find a PDF version of most scripts everywhere. But they're not always going to be exactly what you see on the film, because often things get changed and they don't usually back update a script unless they're going to publish and sell it. But usually what you see is what the final version of the written script was, but things can still change on a shoot and things can change, you know, on set. They can change things with based on actor decision or weather or whatever. So mm-hmm. things do adjust a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other thing I was going to mention before is that when you were talking about how much more dialogue Sam gets here, right? And again, this I think is one of the clearest. When I think about the translation differences, right, between the one language and the other here, just as there are some languages which will like use a lot of like kind of idiosyncratic idioms and others that won't, but really kind of work in other ways. And translating from the one to the other, therefore, like, you know, there are things you're going to have to do. When thinking about book to film, how much more work you have to do in dialogue is a major, major thing, right? Mm. When we look at the work that's being done by Sam's dialogue, destroy it, go on, throw it in the fire. What are you waiting for? Just let it go, right? What's the effect of this, right? This is drawing attention to what is happening in Frodo's head, right? We don't get this in the book. Sam doesn't have to say this out loud in the book, right? Though it's interesting because in some ways, actually, the choice that Frodo makes gets much less attention in the book. Here we're being told Sam's expectation, right? Destroy it. Go on. That's what you're supposed to do. What are you waiting for? Just let it go. The just let it go in particular, right? Enormously draws our attention to like Frodo is having a hard time letting the ring go, right? Like that's what is being very plainly conveyed to us here. Tolkien actually emphasizes very little about that, right? We see him standing there. Yeah. Sam cries, "Master," and then he speaks and says, "I have come, but I do not choose now to do what I came to do.
Mm-hmm.
I will not do this deed. The ring is mine." So we hear him make the choice, but what are the deliberations? What is Sam thinking about it? What's going on in Frodo's head here, right? And ironically, of course, this is like the big non-ring-induced monologue. One of the trends that we see through the Lord of the Rings is that when people are being tempted to claim the ring for themselves, they get a monologue, right?
Yep. Boromir.
Boromir's...
I mean, met as many times, but his is...
His is very famous. Sam's is very famous when he's tempted to take the ring for himself and wants to make Mordor into a garden. Gollum, of course, gets the temptation to, like, be, you know, eat fish fresh from the sea 3 times a day and that kind of thing, right? So, like, everybody, almost everybody gets a ring-induced monologue. Frodo, we don't hear Frodo's ring-induced monologue at this moment, right? There's definitely one happening, but it's completely silent.
But we're not privy to it.
Completely silent. Whereas, again, we are being, our attention is being drawn. It's not Frodo saying it, right? We don't get Frodo narrating it, right? I am standing here on the brink, and I should throw this away, but you know what? I really don't want to do that. Like, we don't get Frodo saying those things.
We don't get that.
Sam's crying out to him draws attention to the fact that that's what's happening, right?
And it's even more so in the film. I mean, Frodo's speech, if that's what you can call it, is cut back to nearly nothing in the film. We can pull up the page. Doesn't he just say, the ring is mine?
Yes.
That's it, right? Yeah, so all that other stuff is kind of removed, which also works tonally that, you know, things said out loud in a more modern audience, you might want to change the cadence a little bit, and it's different from how you read it because there's meter and timbre and all these things. But the language going to Sam just builds up that drive that we get internally for the monologue we don't hear, right? Yes. Like, that's such a weird thing to say, but like, the push of Sam and the silence of Frodo just makes that silence so much weirder.
Yes.
And for Sam to be commanding too, and he calls him master and he's obviously a servant, for him to be commanding Frodo, ordering him what to do, this is wrong, right? There's just so many things that just leave. So that's why that tool is so powerful in the film, that Sam having the power, the words, the push, and having it fall flat because the conversation in Frodo's head is silent but so loud.
Right. And the silent thing that's happening in Frodo's head can also be conveyed just with the image, right? So here's Frodo holding the ring and staring at it, right? And the expression on his face, his posture, right? Again, these are things which would take a lot of time to describe in words, right, and which Tolkien does not do. He leaves us to imagine those things and conveys it in different ways. But here, we don't get we don't get words from Frodo. We get Sam's words to prompt us into what's at stake, and then we see Frodo deliberating and he's monologuing. Internal monologue obviously happening right now, right? But we're not given it.
But also, looking at performance, this in contrast to every other scene that we have of Frodo on film, he's not a bumbling idiot, but he's not steadfast and sure on his feet. He's not resolved in his stances. He's usually moving around a little bit. He's usually a little bit tentative and reactive.
Mm-hmm.
None of that is visible in this shot. And granted, this is a still that is a publicity still, but it is from the film. But this is resolve, you know, he's very much commanding the frame.
Yes. And I agree. I was thinking the same thing that Kairi Rainshadow was saying. She says, I love that almost sneer of his mouth. It feels like a shift in personality. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we see that just as though it hits us much more powerfully here. I do think we are recalling the moment of decision from Isildur in the flashback from Elendil, from Elrond, I mean, earlier in the first film, right? When he makes the decision.
Totally. And J.J. Carr saying too, how similar is this shot to Boromir looking at the ring after picking up out of the snow? Incredibly similar. And it's probably almost a match in terms of if you drew a stick figure, this would be very similar, but in terms of gaze and facial expression, this is worlds apart. Boromir was very curious and tantalizingly you know, wanting it, lusting after it. Frodo's resolved. He's committed to this. He's like, yep.
Yes. And that, by the way, is a really interesting way. So there are both the film and the book are paying off something that they've been doing all the way along, right? The Ring monologues that Tolkien has been giving us, either in through people's dialogue or in people's heads, when they're being tempted to claim the ring. We've seen that now so many times that, again, we know Frodo's having it, right? We don't know exactly what the substance of it is, but we know that it's occurring, right? And so he doesn't have to tell us because we can now imagine that ourselves. Similarly, the film is paying off that, like Isildur, Boromir, Frodo holding up and gazing at the ring like that, right? And so again, we can even if we don't think about it, we can feel that continuity. Like we this has become a kind of like internal archetype within the world of these films, right? So that like he doesn't have to say anything. We know what's going on with him because we've seen it before, right? And so again, and I find those two things similar, but again, it's in a different language, right? It's they're both doing a similar
Yeah.
thing, but it's but the one is purely visual and the other one is like based on blocks of text telling us what people are saying or thinking. Yeah, so I I think, sorry, Ofer Zvani on YouTube was making comments saying, I can see why they add Sam's words here, but I have to say it feels both out of character for Sam, like for Sam to be given commands as you were suggesting, Maggie. And he says, and insulting in a way to the crowd, it seems to voice the audience's feelings, but it seems a bit cheap. I see what you mean, but I don't think I fully agree with that. I mean, there is a way in which I do think it is a common, well, let's say at least a common risk that films have to take or do take to various ex degrees of like how much are you going to spell out, right? How much are you going to leave? And where do you choose your moments to run risks about whether people are going to follow along with what's going on? And I will add that it's easier for those of us who know the book really well to feel like, oh, that didn't have to be said aloud, when like actually kind of maybe it did for people who don't know the books as well as we do. But anyway, but another thing that I would say about that is it's, I think there's also more than just that. Like he says, let it go. By saying let it go, what he's telling us, the thing that is emphasized, it's not just expressing, he's not just being a spokesperson for the audience, you know, who may or may not be shouting at the screen, you know, at this time or something like that. Like I can see that, but I think there's more than that. That expression, let it go. That's so, I mean, like you look at Frodo in this shot, like, dude, it's not that simple, right? This is not, you know, like to Sam, it seems simple. Like we came here for a job. It's right there. Just like do it. You know, just drop it. That's what you came here for. Just let it go. Like, but so one of the things that it really does emphasize is how little Sam understands, right? How little Sam understands of what's going on here and what's at stake. And then of course another thing that I would add is that they're looking to pay off that line in a different way, right? As soon, instead of saying let it go, Sam is going to be saying hold on. Right? And
Right?
that,
I mean,
yeah.
I was just going to say about balance. You know, we talk about balance in Tolkien's texts a lot, but like it happens all the time in film as well. You will see like certain rhythms come out, and you see it in comedy all the time of inverting phrases, and it has a really strong impact visually and language-wise. So to have that let it go, hold on, don't let go, you know, like He literally says, "Don't you let go," right after telling him to let it
To
go.
let it go,
So it works. Yeah, it works. And there is also a certain element, like I definitely see what you're saying of like, oh, it feels a bit trite, but like we almost need that desperate point blank screech of last chance words, please, you know. And because it feels so out of character, it feels more desperate and it feels more panicked. And it does also fill in the gap for those that don't know the text quite as well.
There's a lot more to do. I say instead of either going really late or really rushing it, let's come back to
This
this
is
and talk
so
about this
fun. We
more.
want to keep doing
We
this.
want to keep
So
doing
I,
this. There's more.
yeah,
There's
hope you
more to
guys
do.
stay
We
up for
could, we
this.
still haven't even talked about Gollum in the film. We haven't talked about Sauron in the film. So I want to keep looking at these things. So we'll come back. We'll revisit this same set of slides next
Yeah,
time.
the same slides. Like, there's still a lot to say, and the destruction of the mountain. I want to talk about
The
how it's
destruction.
shot. Like,
The Barad-dûr destruction.
yeah. And then we have at least two other scenes like lined up, ready to go. So I think we're going to do this for a little while,
We're gonna hang here for a bit.
but you're taking a break for a couple weeks, right?
I am, yeah. So unfortunately, we now interrupt this
Usually.
discussion of the cracks of doom, and we'll return in like 3 weeks. But because I'm not gonna be available the next 2 weeks due to work and family travel. So we will come back to it as soon as
That's
we
April
can.
29th.
That's
April
it.
29th
April
plan to be
29th
back.
is when we'll be back. As I say, sorry that it isn't going to be sooner than that, but that's when we're next available.
I
We
think I'm in
will.
California then, so we'll have all the time zones happening.
There we go. There we go. Yeah. So no,
Great.
there's more to see and to talk about here as we look at more of these shots and also keep thinking about the text as well too. Thanks, everybody. Really, really fun discussion today. And we look forward to continuing that next time in a few weeks. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed.
Take care. Bye.